You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
For some, Cancun, Mexico is a sunny escape, but the reality for many is very dark. Like many tourist destinations, Cancun is home to sexual tourism and the trafficking of women and children. Lydia Cacho has dedicated her life to bringing light to that darkness. As a journalist in a country where the number of journalists who die for their work is second only to Iraq, Lydia Cacho dared to name powerful men who were members of a pedophile ring. Her efforts led to prosecutions of some of the perpetrators, but only after she was jailed and tortured because of her reporting. Lydia Cacho is also a co-founder and director of the Refugee Center for Abused Women in Cancun. The work of that center was the focus of Lydia Cacho's keynote speech to the conference Valuing Human Dignity, Challenging the Trafficking of Women. And that conference took place in Vancouver in June. Here's Lydia Cacho.
The fact that when we decided to create the center, it was after 18 years of working, doing grassroots work with Mayan women in Quintana Roo, in the Mayan zone of Mexico, in the southeast area of Mexico, and in Cancun, quite nice hotel place in Mexico with Caribbean blue waters and huge, ugly Florida-like hotels. What we did to open this center and this shelter was to learn from the experience of women in Latin America that were working with shelters and crisis centers. Women from Chile and Argentina and even Guatemala, even though they didn't have crisis centers, they did have a lot of grassroots organizations doing wonderful work. We did go to, of course, Mexican NGOs, and they were back then in the midst of these ugly fights between some groups of the feminist movement, in which each group thought they were right and the others were wrong. So it was a hard time for us because we don't believe in that. We believe in sharing and learning. So we went to the United States and learned from the model that they were developing in the United States and learned from their mistakes and from their triumphs. And we learned at the beginning that all the Americans told us, they were very nice to us, and they said, if you're going to open a crisis center and a shelter, do not separate sexual violence of family violence or domestic violence. We did that, and we did a big mistake because we are now getting that back together. So begin, since the beginning, you go for it. You go for the whole thing. And we did, so we did. They were good teachers. We also went to Spain to see what they were doing with the casas de acogida, the sort of shelters they were opening with a different point of view. And we tropicalized everything, and we made a Mexican model. And it's pretty good. What we knew is that we were in a country, which is the country, Mexico, my country, that has an endemic problem with the justice system. It does not work. We have high levels of corruption. Our levels of corruption are as bad as the ones in Kyrgyzstan. If you know Kyrgyzstan, it's up there near, you know, Afghanistan and those countries on the other side of the world. What I want to say with that is that Mexico is a good, the Mexican government is a good faker. It's like they fake, some people fake orgasm. Mexican government fakes that we have a good justice system, or that we do have justice. However, it's not true. And we have proof of that. Many studies have demonstrated last year that of every 100 crimes that are perpetrated in my country, only 2 of them end up investigated. Which means that we keep wondering, why aren't more criminals in Mexico? Because it's such a good business. Well, a lot of people from around the world is noticing that and going to Mexico to commit crimes, especially crimes against women, and especially crimes of trafficking in persons, specifically women, boys, and girls, for sexual tourism, not only in Cancun, but also in other coastal cities like Puerto Vallarta, Acapulco, which a lot of you might have heard of, and Cabo San Lucas, which is right now like the nicest place, and of course, Oaxaca and some other coastal cities, touristic sites. The same thing that happens in Cancun happens around the world. We know about Thailand, we know about Cambodia, we know about Spain, even England, they are discovering they have sexual tourism. It happens in Cuba, although Fidel Castro swears it doesn't. Well, I don't know what to believe from Fidel right now, but anyway, it does happen. I've been there, and most of you know that it does happen. So we know it's a global issue, and we work at that. Since the beginning of our institution, when we created SIAM Cancun, we didn't know the word trafficking in persons. In Spanish, we call it trata de personas, which is good because we have a difference between trafficking, which we call tráfico, and trata, which is the exploitation itself of people. There is a misunderstanding still within politicians because they take the word in English, trafficking in person, and they take it to Spanish and they say tráfico de personas, and they have no idea what they're talking about, which includes our legislators. But it's true. So anyway, we're educating ourselves in these new terms. But since the first client that we received in SIAM Cancun, almost 10 years ago, she was a woman with three girls, and she went to seek for shelter because the three girls were being sold, sexually exploited by their own father, who was a taxi driver. He was taking them around Cancun, selling them to tourists. The mother noticed, finally, the girl said, and she went to SIAM. So when we began with a trafficking person's case, which we didn't call it that. We called it gender violence and sexual violence and family violence altogether. What we do in our center is we work in a holistic approach. We do not have much money, as most countries don't have enough money ever for these centers. We know that. We just recently passed a law, I have to say recently, last year, in which violence against women is a crime. Before that, it wasn't. It wasn't even a misdemeanor. If a woman came with a battering situation, she had to be so badly beaten that the wounds wouldn't heal before 15 days. That was the law. The law said, if the wounds heal before 15 days, then it's not a crime. That's what the law said. So police sent women back home. So we changed that law. We worked at that, all the groups with our problems. We did a good job. Now we have a law. Now the problem is the justice system doesn't work. So we go around it, you know, we learn our ways to do it. And one thing that we learned when we opened SIAM was, okay, we have to develop a professional model in which we have to understand one thing. We are going to become professionals in building inner peace and outer peace. That is our goal. We are not going to work with violence, as a lot of people says. We are going to be working, building peace. In order to do that, we have to set a list of ethical rules that we will apply to ourselves. So we decided, let's say that we create all these instruments for interviewing the victims. There are not yet survivors, but when they come to us, they're still victims. And although there's a discussion in that issue, we decided in our group to differentiate when they are still victims in the situation and when they become survivors. They do decide it, we don't, but we decided when, how to call them within the group. So what we did first was all our group, all of us, were willing to be able to interview each other, the psychologists, the social workers, all of us that were, I am a journalist, but I've been trained as a social worker since I was a teenager with my mom. So the social workers, the nurses, the doctors, the security gals, because we have a good security team, we all know judo, and I will explain why. We're nonviolent, but we know how to defend ourselves. We're nonviolent, but we're not idiots, so we know how to, you know, cope with that. So we started doing these exercises in which we sat in front of each other and apply all these long interviews. And it was quite an overwhelming exercise because it's powerful, isn't it? When we work in these issues, we have so much power. It's the same power that a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a doctor has over somebody that comes to them and say, I'm sick and I don't know. I really don't. I know how we feel, but I really don't know why. And you are the expert and you're going to tell me. So after these exercises, after we cried and we learned how you feel, how vulnerable you feel when you sit in front of someone you hardly know and you have to tell them your life story. But I'm talking about your life story. If you were touched when you were a little girl or a little boy, if you were molested by anyone, if you ever felt that you felt that you were in a situation of violence in which we had no way to escape, if your father loved you, if your mother loved you, if you have a good relationship with them, if you have a network of people that would help you. And then when you're answering, the questions, which are very good questions, will lead you, the person telling the story, to understand, to truly understand if your network is for real. If your mother would be there for you if you escape a bad marriage, if you take a decision or think you're taking a decision to go off and be in a situation of exploitation, and then you go back, if they will really take you in, if they won't tell you you deserve what you got because you did not obey. It is hard and it's powerful. And we learned that we were working with power. And we also knew that all human beings have the ability to work from the dark side of themselves. We all have one. The ones that said they don't have one, I have news for you. Well, we have a dark side, but we also have a luminous side. And we have to keep on working on that all the time, especially when we work in these issues. Because sometimes we tend to think that we are here to help others. And what we have learned, what I have learned in these years is that I work in this business of building inner and outer peace, because I truly need to become a better person. Every day I work at that. And I learn from the women and the children that come to our center and that decide that are brave enough to go to the shelter, high security shelter, to save their lives or their integrity. And so we are here working to learn. And that's why we decided we would no, we will not work with psychiatrists or medicine. What I'm drugs. What I mean is that, as you must know, 30% of the women that claim that they are living in a highly violent situation are diagnosed with some sort of mental illness. So as we say, it's not that you are crazy and you get into a violent situation or relationship, but it's that you are in a relationship or in a situation that is driving you crazy. because something within you is telling you that is not a good thing, that is not good for you, and that is not fair. But everything around you is telling you that is what it is, and that if you don't have the tools to get out, you're a fool, or you're stupid, or you're crazy. So that's what society usually tells us in every culture. Maybe in Canada it's more sophisticated, but it still works. We know that everywhere in the world works. That's why violence against women keeps increasing around the world. So we decided we would work with a holistic approach, and we work with, we have a Chinese medicine expert in our shelter that works with acupuncture and with works with bach flowers and that works with energetical massage for women and children. And it's wonderful, because some women that have come to us with a paper that says that the State Department medical officials said that she does not deserve to keep her children because she's crazy, she's schizophrenic. The doctors like that. When they don't know what to do, they said, oh, okay, do you live in a violent situation? Oh, okay, yeah. Do you want to go out? Well, yeah, but I don't have the money. Oh, you're schizophrenic. You know, schizophrenia or psychosis or something like that. They like those words. So they do that, diagnose that easily. It sounds like a joke, but it's not, unfortunately. So what we do is that we have demonstrated over the past of 6 years that only one woman truly needed the medicine that a psychiatrist was giving her, and we took her to a good psychiatrist, and she kept on going. And the reason why we do it is because in Mexico we don't have a social security system that can pay for this medicine. So it would be unfair to a woman to come into a shelter for 3, 6, or 8 months and stay there and develop her own tools to become a free woman, and the kids would go to school for peace. She would learn how to deal with the kids, and she would dream for a better life and take one pill every night and then get out of the shelter and have no money to pay for the $200 a week for the treatment, psychiatrist treatment. So we decided we'd go with this alternative medicine, and it works. Works like magic. And it's really cheap, and we can give it away to women. So they come back to the center, and they use it until one day they come, they say, I don't need it anymore. We also teach them how to do yoga, which is quite important to keep you centered and find peace within. We all do yoga. So everything that the woman in the shelter and the center do, we do first. We have no right in our institution, in our organization, to ask a woman or a child to do anything that we are not willing to do. That means we have rules. If a woman or a child exercises violence within the group, in the shelter, and is not willing to negotiate and develop tools with the group to get forgiveness, not forced forgiveness, but to negotiate peacefully, and they keep on expressing themselves with violence, they can no longer live in the shelter. So it's the same thing for us. If we tend a woman, and if they come to the shelter and to crisis center, and we're too tired, and we don't eat, you know, we tend to be sort of, we don't like to treat ourselves very well when we work in these NGOs, we're sort of masochist, a little masochist. So what we do is we take each other of each one. Everyone has to eat lunch. Everyone has to have breakfast when they get to the office. We have a nice kitchen, and the kitchen is very, very nice because it's good to be there. It's a place where you share, we in the office share. We have a place where the kids of everyone that works in the center can be if they are too small to be at the kindergarten or other place where they can be taken care of. And we have volunteers that are good friends of ours that take care of our kids. So what we do is we follow the philosophy of do unto others that you want to do unto you, and vice versa. And it works. It has worked wonderfully. I want to tell you a story that shows how what we do works and what people decide to do make it work. There was a little boy called Raul. His mother was trafficked. It was internal trafficking. She was from Chiapas, a state, a southern state, a Mayan southern state. And he took her to Cancun, and he was exploiting her sexually. So she escaped with a kid. And she escaped not because she noticed that she was being exploited and she thought it was wrong, because she thought she deserved it. After all these women before her were abused, were beaten, were mistreated in their communities, and everybody said that it was okay, that's what women deserve. She did ask for help because she noticed one day that Raul, the little boy, she was back then, he was 4 years old, was being abused by his father. Once she noticed and Raul explained that he was, then she took the decision and went to her center and then ended up in the shelter. So the woman was doing her work, you know, doing the yoga and the massage and doing the therapy and getting working skills and, unloading all this thing, as the French call it, shit, that she has gathered within the years. And Raul was quite a small, tiny boy, aggressive, quite aggressive. One day he almost opened a big door at the office just doing this. So he's strong. One day he was drawing in the floor. He wouldn't talk to anyone. And I am drawing something on the board. And he looks at me from the floor and he said, "Oh, Lidia Cacho, you're so big. I bet you're taller than my dad." And I said, "Sure, I bet so. I don't know about that, but I've seen his picture." And he looks at me, he said, "He couldn't get into the shelter, could he?" And I said, "Of course not. We're too strong. See, we have cameras outside. We have, all sort of security systems, so he wouldn't get in here." He goes, "And if he did try, you would beat the hell out of him, wouldn't you?" And I said, "Sure, absolutely." So Raul, all of a sudden, picked me up as his heroine of the day, and he was like talking. So the therapist, the child therapist, he's a man, this is important, because he is part of the Chinese medicine group, and he's also a child therapist. This is important because we need for boys, little boys and little girls, to understand there are good men in the world. So if you know more good men, please join the centers and the shelters. So the therapist told me that he was going to work with Raul now that he wanted to talk, after he knew I could beat the hell out of his father. So Raul made this huge drawing, and the therapist showed it to me, and it's like a black paper in which there's a little boy down here and there is a man up here, and the man had, it's naked, and his penis is drawn like a gun. And he didn't even explain that. I didn't ask Raul to explain anything. He just was showing what he felt like, and the therapist worked with Raul on that. So the therapist said, "Okay, listen, Raul thinks you're, you know, the hero of the day, so talk to him. Let's see how he feels, if he can take down his violent side." He was going to School for Peace, which I will explain how it works, because it's a basic of basis of our organization. He would go to School for Peace every day. He would go to regular school too, which keeps them more integrated. And he didn't like to negotiate. You know, he was like, "No, why should I negotiate? I'm the man of the house." He was 4. So I sat with him in the garden and I said, "Raul, listen, you know, I like you a lot. Can I give you a hug?" And he goes, "No, you can't." I said, "Why?" "Because I am a boy and I don't have a heart." I said, "What do you mean you don't have a heart?" He said, "No, my father told me that I was a little dog and I did not have a heart. So I hate my dad, but I am like him." And I said, "What do you want to be when you grow up, Raul?" He said, "When I grow up, I want to be a killer, and I'm going to take my dad's heart out like he tried to take my mom's heart out." Needless to say, I didn't have anything else to say, but I took him to the office. I drew a little heart, a paper heart. I wrote his name. I cut the heart. I went to look for a bobby pin, and I put the heart in his t-shirt. And I said, listen, Raul, let's make a deal. This is your heart, and you will wear this all the time you are in the shelter, and you will think that this heart will go inside. And every time you hug your mom, every time you smile, every time you play football, you play with the other kids, every time you go to the gardens and plant something, tomatoes, or when you go to the recycling center in the shelter and do the work with other kids, then you will feel how the paper heart will start pounding. Let's see if it works. And he took it really seriously. So I would go to the office and travel a little and go back to the shelter. And then one day when I came back, Raul asked me, Lydia, next time you come, you better let me know that you're coming because I have to get ready. And I said, okay, sure. So I did that. Every time I was going to the shelter, I told them, please tell Raul I'm going. So he would get his heart like this and then go to the pin. And the heart was like really dirty, but he was like, really proud of it. And I don't know how he managed. He never explained, but the other kids never laughed at his paper heart. So I kept coming to the shelter and talking to him, and then he would run for the heart and forget, you know, he had to put it on and then put it on. I had it before, but I was playing football and stuff like that. So anyway, I was taken to jail, and some bad things happened, and I was tortured and all this for writing a book on pedophiles. And everyone in the team and everyone at the shelter knew that this was happening to me because it was on the news and everyone knew. So Raul wrote me a couple of letters. So when I was able to get out of jail and I went to the shelter and I talked to my whole team and we made like a ceremony of welcoming in freedom and all that, I was back and I was alive, so I was really happy with that. And we celebrated that. We celebrated that the bad guy, one of the bad guys, was in jail, so we were quite happy. And Raul came to the center where we were having the ceremony, and he just standing there. So when we finished, I went to him and I said, Raul, where is your heart? You know? And he goes, Lydia Cacho, they took you to jail. And they did bad things to you. And I said, yeah. They are really bad. He said, yes, they are bad. But I'm here. I'm back. I said, where is your heart? And he just hugged my legs really hard. And he said, I don't need it anymore. So this was truly one of the best moments in my life. And it truly made sense because that's when I came back from going to jail for telling the truth about a network of pedophiles and traffickers, child traffickers. A year passed by before I was able to get out of going to jail to sign every week instead of staying in jail for 4 years. And I won the case 1 year after that because they couldn't prove that I lied, and I could prove the network of child abusers and traffickers exist. And every time I was tired and I was like, oh God, I can't with this, I'm gonna go live in Canada or Spain or somewhere and ask for asylum. This is, you know, this is a terrible country. There's no way to change this. I kept thinking of Raul's heart. And that reminded me that this little boy that was maybe in a situation that in which he could become a rapist, a boy that hated men as well as women. He hated his mom when he was very young because he thought she wouldn't notice that he was suffering, right? So she wasn't a good mom. So he didn't trust her. He sort of liked her, but he didn't trust her. So we worked with trust a lot with Raul. But on the other hand, he hated his dad because he was doing things that he didn't like, that hurt him. Basically his body, because he didn't realize sexuality as we do. And I think that's something I've learned from kids, that sometimes our taboos are making it harder for kids to understand how to survive sexual violence. And I think that we have to be really careful with that, with making judgments, specifically because we're making the judgment from our own taboos instead of from the point of view of the child. So what Raul did within the 5 months he stayed in the shelter was he ended up working at the School for Peace. And the School for Peace is very simple. Most of you will know how it works because we took the UN model that they use in refugee situation, refugee camps, and we tropicalize it again. We like to tropicalize things in Mexico. We live in the tropics. So we sort of give, you know, the whole team got together with the mothers and decided how to do it so it would work, because we have Mayan boys and really poor boys and kids that cannot speak, and we had a blind boy, and we have girls that do not talk because they are afraid of talking and they are submissive because that's how they learn to be a woman in their homes. And we have little girls that go to, you know, like a high class school, and they are out there talking and really angry, and, you know, they are white. And we have all sorts of kids and all sorts of women there. And they learn how to live in a universe that is a space they create every day. And they build peace every day. That is what we exercise. So in the School for Peace, what they do is if a kid has a problem, for example, a girl and a boy have a big fight, the mothers talk to the kids, but also the kids talk to the kids. So after they have a problem, they go to the School for Peace, they have one of the teachers for peace, and which is one of the staff girls, and the mothers observe. And the kids sit there, they have a little bell in the center. So the girl or the boy that was the one who was hurt, because, you know, they beat him, insulted him, or whatever they did. They do a lot of things, kids. And so the girl or the boy that is insulted, takes the bell, or rings the bell, which is, I have a turn to talk. And she or he explains, after training, of course, how she feels and how she thinks. This is really important because that's what we learn, how we work in the team, and what we teach mothers and children. If you learn to differentiate how you feel and how you think, and you get these two things together in such a way that you can express truly what is going on instead of making judgment of what you thought the other wanted you to feel, things are absolutely negotiable. You can negotiate almost anything. The first rule is we are all equal. So girls and boys are equal, and they have the same right to talk and express their feelings and their thoughts. That applies for boys and girls, which inserts in our program of masculinity and femininity, in our gender perspective, which is overall the program. So the girls, for example, the girl was there playing, and the boy came, and, you know, he kicked her and said, hey, you know. So the girl is really insulted, and she just rings the bell, and she said, you kicked me, and that felt really bad because you hurt my leg. And then the teacher says, okay, and what do you think? Why do you think he hurt you? He kicked you. So he goes, I don't know. I want you to tell me. So the boy answers. He tugs the bell, he rings the bell, and he starts explaining how he feels, how he felt, why he kicked the girl. Usually it's amazing when you listen to kids, even kids even to 15 or 16 years old, I'm not talking about only small children, you would be amazed of how fast they learn how to negotiate their crisis. It's amazing. And once they understand how it feels and how they think and how we usually interpret what the others are saying, and we don't listen to others, but we're all the time trying to, no, she's looking at me because she thinks I'm boring, and, you know, look at her feet going like this. She's like, oh my God, when is Lydia gonna stop talking? So we do that all the time, don't we? We think too much of ourselves, usually. Well, kids don't. They stop that immediately. And they learn how to negotiate and how to say, I'm sorry. And it's amazing how many children that come from really, really bad situations, incredibly violent situations, boys and girls are able to say, I kick you because that's what my dad did, and I didn't notice. Or I kick you because you weren't, lying there, and I don't know, I just felt like it. And then you have a girl saying, well, I'm not a ball. Next time, you play with a ball. So the teacher would say, do you want to give him a ball to play with you? Yeah, sure. And they start negotiating. We never tell a kid or a woman to ask forgiveness to anyone. We do not believe in that. I don't know if that happened to you when I was a little girl. My mom, that was a psychologist, and she went through all her phases, Freudian, and then Ericksonian, and humanist, and whatever, Jungian. And so what my mom did was she would gather us with my sisters and brothers, and we had a problem, and she would go ask, and then forgive each other. And I'm like, no way. I don't want to forgive him. For a day or two, he should be guilty for what he did. Well, we don't do that because it doesn't work. It doesn't come from your heart. What comes from your heart is dealing with your emotions and learning how to love each other. So we have the second part of the School for Peace, which is School for Love. And it's the skills that we develop for loving each other and what love means to each one of us, how we develop tools to love and respect the earth, which is why we have all these gardens in which every family has a piece of the garden and they plant everything they want, tomatoes, lettuce, anything they want, they plant. That's why we have the recycling system there, because if you treat the earth as you would like to be treated, then the earth will give you food. It will treat you correctly. We go to the ocean. We have the ocean pretty near. So we go to the ocean, to certain hotels with which we have deals, and kids can swim in the ocean and with their mothers and do exercises and yoga there. So at the end, this is just a little example of the things that we're doing. What I can tell you is that only 3% of the women since we opened go back to their batterers. That is a very low number. And that has nothing to do with us. It has a lot to do with the way women decide to build their tools.
We were listening there to Lydia Cacho speaking at the conference Valuing Human Dignity, Challenging the Traffic of Women, and that took place just recently in Vancouver. A member of the audience asked for a more detailed explanation about the need to understand child sexual abuse from the child victim's perspective. Here's Lydia Cacho's response.
Yes, we've been studying child abuse and child pornography because we have all these new issues that we are learning to understand now. I guess around the world there's this psychological movement, there's all these groups that are thinking differently. Some work from anger, some work from hating all men, and they think all men are rapists. Some work from a humanist point of view in which they think that everyone has a chance to become a good human being. I belong to that group. So anyway, most of the groups working in Argentina, which would, that are training us in child abuse, and our own experience have taught us that children, for example, a 4, 5, or 6-year-old that has been raped, abused even by the father, a priest, somebody, has no knowledge of that being a sexual abuse. They understand this is some sort of abuse that they do not like, and that it has, that is somehow linked to an emotional relationship of trust with the other person. So what we do is we work with the trust, we work with the acknowledgement of their right to tell the truth, to not like what they felt like. Most of the kids, when they show you that they were raped, girls and boys, they do not have any idea that that is sex. They are not formed for that. That's why abusers take kids from 6 years old until they're 13, because not even our brains are ready to understand, to have a real profound understand of what sexuality and erotic feelings are. What they do feel is that the warmth of the hugs, and they do not relate it to erotism, they relate it to kindness. That is why it's so hard. And most of the kids, I will tell you really fast, I'm sorry about this, but there was this little girl I interviewed. She was 7 years old. She was raped by her uncle, the favorite uncle, and she was there sitting in my office. The mother was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And the daughter is just looking at the mother. And so I took the mother out with one of the social workers, and I talked to the kid, and she was so nice, and she was saying, he was touching my vagina, and I didn't like, and I said, who told you that's your vagina? And she said, my teacher at school. And I said, okay, good. And I said, why didn't you like it? What happened? And he said, we're watching Pocahontas on TV, and he's just telling me that I could be a princess, and he's touching my vagina, and it hurt. And I said, okay. And I said, how did it hurt? And she goes, like when somebody really pinches your arm. And I don't like anyone pinching my arm. She never made a comment related to erotism, sexuality, rape. She was telling me that she was being abused in such a way it hurt. So if you work from there with the therapist and the social worker and the, you know, the massage and everyone that is, she's recovering her own body and claiming her body not to be hurt in any way by anyone, but not from a sexual point of view or stand of view, then she claims her body and her sexuality when she grows up. And it has no link. So we're learning that, and it's quite interesting. And I have to say this because it's important. I am a survivor of rape. I was raped badly and ended up in a hospital because of my work. And I really enjoy sex. I don't want to brag, but sometimes I'm even multi-orgasmic. So what I want to say is that we can survive. We are survivors. And kids are too. So we go from there.
That was Lydia Cacho speaking at the forum Valuing Human Dignity, Challenging the Trafficking of Women, and that forum took place in Vancouver last month.